It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition, it says our state is short more than 120,000 affordable places to live for families who are below the poverty line. And that's the most recent evaluation from 2021. We explore the possibilities of adaptive reuse of buildings that are standing idle. Call in with a question about repurposing and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joe Pena is a senior research associate at the American Planning Association. Joe, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So your organization says reusing existing buildings to create affordable housing is on the rise in our country. Why the increase in adaptive reuse projects?
We are seeing so many different projects where folks are rethinking how they use the space that's available to them, the structures that are already in place, and adapting those to their current needs and conditions in their community. We're also seeing a lot of stressor around housing availability. So a recent report by Up for Growth reported that there's a 3.8 million home shortfall in annual housing production. And so because of that, there might be pressures for communities to identify options to enhance housing choice with, you know, what they've got available and hopefully be able to stay within budget. So lots of pressures to figure out creative solutions and using what you have to make do.
It sounds,
and then some.
Yes, it sounds like there is this storm that is being created with all of these influencing things that is really driving at pressures to turn to these buildings that are standing idle. And I wonder, can you talk about the beauty of taking a building that has outlived its, you know, original purpose or its original use and giving it new life with a new purpose?
Yeah, so a lot of the structures that folks might be interested in preserving in their communities are reflections of values that communities have had for a long time. Some of the structures that we're seeing are intricate. They have special designs, special construction practices that may not be able to be replicated today. So preserving some of these buildings and bringing new life into them can help preserve that community character and then also help in redefining what is our community need now? How can we make the best use of what's currently there? And then at the same time, enhance the surrounding access to different sorts of amenities. So adaptive reuse projects may be located in areas where folks can access their public library. They might be able to access a grocery store, variety of different places where folks may need to get to, including workplaces, and you know, in order to live healthy, whole lives right in their neighborhood.
So that building being very much connected to place, connected to community and its surroundings, that being really important is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. We're also seeing, you know, a significant interest too in preserving some open spaces. So if you can remove some of the building pressure, provide an outlet for development that doesn't necessarily take away from green spaces that a community values, that's an extra benefit. And then the additional benefits of economic development opportunities, right? So if you're able to create spaces for commerce, spaces for folks who are interested in starting off their small business and making those accessible at different price points, then yeah, you can cultivate a healthier, robust community environment.
We're going to turn to Wisconsin here. One recent adaptive reuse project is underway in Oshkosh. How do you see this project as an example of adaptive reuse where you take an old elementary school and convert it into affordable housing units?
Yeah, there's a couple of projects that have focused on taking spaces that were previously serving educational purposes and transforming those into housing options. What's really neat about those sorts of conversions is that oftentimes those buildings have special value to community members, so folks who might have gone to school there or folks who might have worked in in that building. And so making sure that the building is available for a new use can help keep that through line, that consistency in a community, and then also help provide options for folks who are looking for different housing opportunities. And it sounds like this project too focuses on affordable housing. So being able to provide options for folks who are looking for more accessible spaces. And so yeah, it's exciting to see all those sorts of different projects that are taking place around the country. And this project at Oshkosh could really have some good learning opportunities for folks who are looking for other conversions from schools to housing and beyond.
Joe Pena with us, research senior research associate at the American Planning Association, as we talk about affordable housing and adaptive reuse and taking your questions along the way. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. What would you like to ask?
There's been a lot of changes in an eminent domain law that allows the government to take land for a variety of different purposes. And it seems to me that we have a lot of rich, white, predominantly people that live in very wealthy neighborhoods such as Bishop's Bay with a lot of land. Why not use eminent domain to create low-income housing in those communities? It's a lot cheaper to start from scratch than it is to rehabilitate a building. And we have lots of land that's sitting out there with a lot of rich progressives that talk about the need for low-income housing. It seems like a perfect fit.
Joe, what are your insights there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a lot of the times the value behind adaptive reuse is reimagining. So figuring out what can still be used. Necessity is sometimes the mother of invention. And what we've seen in the research is that rehabilitation projects can, or adaptive reuse projects can span the range, in terms of costs, but in many instances, they can provide a more affordable cost, I would say, to the community. So instead of starting from scratch and figuring out, all of everything from the ground floor up, you've got something that you can work with and try to convert. But every situation is different,
And it
and
sounds like
often.
it starts with a plan. And I'm wondering, what does a community plan entail when you're looking at those first steps of an adaptive reuse project?
Yeah, Kate, I'm glad you're mentioning that because plans often outline the priorities for the community. So if you've got plans in place that are looking critically at what you need in your community, then you can take strategic action to figure out how can we meet these needs. And so depending on what a community might feel, they may feel, okay, well, we want to reinvest in this commercial corridor or potentially educational facilities that have had historic public investment. You can adapt your approaches for affordable housing from there.
Let's go to Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. I was wondering about the issue of maintenance costs on older buildings. Using the example of a school, we often have school referendums, and one of the reasons is that we're told the buildings are older, they require more maintenance, so the costs are higher. So how do you reconcile that issue by when you're using older buildings? Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Joe, what about those mechanical systems and those aging infrastructure, of the building itself?
Yeah, in situations where you're looking at systems that have been around for a long time, it's important to work in partnership. So community planners are often looking at bigger picture perspectives and trying to meet community needs and visions for the future with what's currently available. So in instances where we're thinking about maintenance, potentially other questions such as public health considerations and all of that and beyond, it's important to collaborate across different allied professions. So making sure that you've got your building inspectors on board, public health officials, variety of different folks who know what's on the ground and understand the requirements for what needs to happen in order to create and enhance living spaces and other community amenities.
Joe Pena is with us, Senior Research Associate at the Chicago-based American Planning Association, the membership organization for urban planners. Call in with comments about converting underutilized buildings. Join in with a question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss momentum for renovating empty buildings or distressed buildings, making them into viable multifamily homes. And this is Wisconsin and the nation confront a shortage of affordable housing. Join in at any point about adaptive reuse. Call in with a question, a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Senior Research Associate at the American Planning Association, Joe Pena, is here. Joe, your association supports changing federal zoning laws. And as you look at zoning, how do these laws create barriers for affordable housing projects?
Yeah, the American Planning Association has been working in partnership with the National League of Cities to identify different solutions for addressing housing shortages. And so thinking about ideas such as improving local capacity, identifying critical solutions, and leading zoning reforms are all different sorts of approaches that will help enable communities to meet their housing needs. So a lot of the times the questions around adaptive reuse are, you know, how can this serve our community? And so if we're seeing that there's an increased demand for affordable housing, being able to equip planners and other professionals, elected officials, community members to make decisions for their communities that are going to help relieve the needs is a priority for APA.
I always wonder why rezoning can't be more nimble, why it is a long process, and I understand it's also a costly process. What is behind that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of the times when we're looking at zoning reform, it's a matter of reviewing systems that have been in place for some time and potentially challenging some of the givens or we've always done things this way. Every community is going to have a different sort of system in place, right, to address zoning reform. So in terms of cost, that can vary from community to community. But ultimately, what's important is being able to expand housing choice. So as we're seeing that, you know, there is increased demand for places to live, what can we do to help community members have access to places that are healthy and where they can access the amenities that they need in order to live whole lives?
What is your advice to community leaders who get opposition to affordable housing projects from their residents?
Yeah, so I think in instances where there's potentially questions around what does housing affordability mean or how might this impact my community, it's important to consider, you know, what are the concerns of community members? And then from there, work towards understanding whose voices are overrepresented, whose voices are not represented in conversations, and identify where we can provide the most amount of benefit for the most amount of people. Planners have an ethical obligation to promote an increase in supply and an increase in the supply and quality of affordable housing, and also to improve services and facilities with equal access to all residents. So I would say engage your planners and, you know, make sure you bring in other folks into the conversation to have a discussion on what does it mean for our community to be able to offer more housing choices.
I want to zoom in on that equal access to all residents, that equity piece of it, because, you know, when you're converting existing buildings into you know, different housing types of, you know, projects, how do community leaders ensure the price remains affordable to the residents who will live in these new spaces?
Yeah, that's an important question that requires close inspection of standards for affordable housing. So different communities might use metrics such as area median income, for example, to identify what might be a suitable price point. And granted, there are no perfect systems, but I think taking a data-centered approach to that conversation can help identify, again, where you can provide the most amount of benefit for the most amount of people. And then again, engaging allied professionals who are interested in affordable housing. A lot of times local area partners might have a sophisticated understanding of what a community needs in order to expand housing choice at a point, or to a point where, you know, it is accessible to all community members.
We're looking at that urban planning vision toward affordable housing. Joe Pena is Senior Research Associate at the American Planning Association. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. John is with us from Boaz. John, what would you like to share?
I think it's a good thing to take an industrial building that's completely abandoned for economic reasons and convert it into residential living spaces like condominiums and apartment buildings. Did you ever hear of the word cold water flat? Well, that's where I'm living right now, but it's been 10 years. And as long as I have electricity, I can heat my water, which is necessary for making coffee.
Do you live in an adapted space? You said an abandoned building. What type of building?
It was an old feed mill.
Okay. And has been converted. John, thank you. And I'm wondering, Joe Pena, do you have, I know that you've seen adaptive reuse of abandoned buildings like old factories. What are your insights there?
Yeah, there's a variety of projects. In Wisconsin, especially, I've seen coverage on different sorts of spaces like feed mill buildings, warehouses, and canning facilities, et cetera, that are quite interesting projects. It sounds like with some of these projects, you know, they can serve many purposes. So ranging, you know, from the conversation of affordable housing to increasing amenities and access for residents in the area. And so, yeah, I think with any adaptive reuse project, if folks are considering access for all community members, then they can definitely provide benefit to a community.
One perhaps adaptive reuse that we have our eye on here in Wisconsin is the property of Cardinal Stritch University that went on the market recently. And it's 43-acre campus in Fox Point. It's dorms, classrooms, a library, dining hall, field house, fine arts center. How often are large properties redeveloped for housing?
That's a good question. It's hard for me to say, speaking from the perspective of, you know, planners and trying to equip folks with the tools in order to assess the properties that are available to them. But yeah, for larger spaces like that, there are opportunities to think about, well, what purposes can these buildings meet for our community? So is it that we want to increase access to maybe grocery stores? There are areas around the country that don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, or perhaps green space. Yeah, thinking about how to take those larger spaces and meet potentially more than one need might be a very interesting approach to, again, encourage healthy living for all residents.
How do you encourage community leaders to connect with residents on this issue? Because some person might see a different vision for a building or an area.
Yeah, community engagement is key with these topics. So understanding what are the needs, what are the wants, what are some of the concerns, and then trying to take an approach, you know, where we are providing the facts and thinking about, well, how can, you know, we meet as much benefit as possible for all. So definitely encourage folks to get involved in their local community planning processes. And yeah, share your perspectives, because at the end of the day, community planners are here to help meet the needs of folks who are living in these spaces.
Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joe Pena is Senior Research Associate at the American Planning Association. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an evolving city.
Cities inevitably change through the decades. People move in and out. Businesses come and go. Oftentimes, these shifts are the most obvious in your own neighborhood. Author and historian John Gerda has been reflecting on changes surrounding his childhood home in Milwaukee. He talks about how waves of immigration continue adding to the rich history of this beloved neighborhood.
I have decided what I want to be when I retire. Not a teller of cautionary tales to the young, not an ache-by-ache chronicler of my ongoing deterioration, and not, heaven forbid, a golfer. What I want to be is something much simpler, an old guy on a bike who rides around looking at things. I might stop once in a while to buy a donut, raise a glass of beer, or fall into casual conversation, but I'll mainly be a witness to change, content to observe the passing scene and enjoy what poet Wallace Stevens called the pleasures of merely circulating. I had a foretaste of that experience on a recent two-wheel tour of my first neighborhood. Until I was 8 years old, my family lived in Layton Park on the southern edge of Milwaukee's Old South Side. The reason we lived there was generational. My Polish grandparents, John and Mary Gerda, ran a hardware store in the heart of the neighborhood at 32nd and Lincoln from 1915 to 1965. And my father, Art, was the oldest of four kids raised behind the store. When he and my mother, Claire, a farm girl from western Wisconsin, settled in Milwaukee after World War II, it was entirely natural for them to build a little house on South 34th Street, only 8 blocks from the hardware store, and start a family of their own. The Layton Park of Art Gerda's youth had been decidedly mixed. The residents were almost entirely white, but mixed in those days usually had a European connotation. Germans and Poles were almost evenly matched in the neighborhood, some transplanted from the old country, and others born here but still speaking their ancestral tongues. Any business person who hoped to prosper had to have a working knowledge of both languages, and my grandparents were no exception. Fast forward 60 years. My wife Sonia and I lived in Layton Park during the first years of our marriage, just 2 blocks from the used car lot that had replaced Gerda Hardware. The neighborhood was still largely German and Polish, but what a change was on the horizon. In 1980, soon after we left for Bayview, Latino Milwaukeeans made up less than 3% of Central Layton Park's population. By 2010, the number had soared to 73%, and it continues to grow. The changes go well beyond statistics. Sunday Mass at my grandparents' old church, St. Barbara's, is now said in Spanish. Layton Park Lutheran is now Templo Adventista del Séptimo Día, a Seventh-day Adventist congregation. Thibault and Johnson Funeral Home, where roughly half my relatives made their last public appearances, has become Iglesia Cristiana Palabra de Vida, Word of Life Christian Church. Taverns where my grandfather once bent an elbow now play Spanish corridos on the jukebox, and the occasional Mexican flag waves from the front porch of a bungalow that might have been built with nails from Gerda Hardware. Changing neighborhoods provide a wealth of material for meditations on impermanence, but they also underline a fundamental truth about urban life. Everything is in motion. Neighborhoods are like vessels, like shells, built by one group and inhabited by a succession of others. Each group makes its own memories and then moves on. As pop singer Jewel succinctly put it, everything's temporary if you give it enough time.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee-born writer and historian. He's written 23 books on the history of the city. His most recent one is Brewtown Tales, More Stories from Milwaukee and Beyond. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The bath and kitchen fixtures giant Kohler Company appoints its first chief sustainability and diversity, equity, and inclusion officer. We're in conversation with Laura Kohler about corporate environmental sustainability goals and social impact. And you can call in with your questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Kohler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. So glad to be here.
So let's talk about climate. By 2035, Kohler aiming to reduce or offset 100% of its greenhouse gas emissions. How much progress is the company making on net zero?
So, you know, we've been going at this. We set that goal back in 2008. And net zero by 2035 in waste, water, and GHG. So it has been a journey, continues to be one. We are very proud to hit our reduction targets every year, which is at least 3% across those three, waste, water, and GHG. And so our ESG report comes out in a few weeks for 2022, and you can see some of our, publicly, some of our record progress. And we're constantly really looking at new technologies and new ways to solve problems and go after our biggest challenges. So we're on this journey with many other companies, but we've been going at it for quite some time.
And GHG, greenhouse gas emissions and removals, and that is set by the U.S. EPA. How does Kohler measure whether its greenhouse gas emissions are being fairly offset?
Well, So I think there's a couple of things. It's very complicated, and we follow GRI standards. We measure, we have 55 manufacturing facilities around the world. So we're very focused first on our operating footprint in those locations. We also look at our, obviously, every office location. And so all of those locations feed into really our sustainability team here in Wisconsin. And we spend the year really measuring and managing how we're doing against our targets. And then we use the ESG framework, really the GRI standards, to really publicly report how we're doing. And I would say that it is ever complex. People understand really that data gathering is super important to understanding where you are as a company, especially when you have complex manufacturing. And we also have been really proud of an investment we've made in a wind farm facility called Diamond Vista. And that relationship with the wind farm over the last 6 years, I would say, has really offset 100% of our energy use in the United States and Canada, 52% of our usage globally. So we want to be able to certainly use renewable energy and credits to offset, but we also want to continue to improve our own footprint.
GRI standards, like for waste or occupational health and safety and other areas, I want to zoom in on waste here, and sending solid waste to landfills. You want to stop doing that by 2035. What steps is Kohler taking to achieve this goal on solid waste?
So every year we give a challenge to our manufacturing facilities and set a target around which facilities will be zero waste for that year. So in 2021, I believe we had, no, in 2022, we had 7 facilities hit that target of zero net waste. And in this year, we have another 3 going to join that group. So that is not easy for a manufacturing facility. So what that means is, you know, the production of the whatever material and product they're making has to, you know, it has to have high yields, right? So, so high quality that doesn't yield a lot of waste in the process. And then if there is waste in the process, that that waste is either reused in some fashion, you know, in a circular way, or it is repurposed to, let's say, roadbeds or some other, functionality. So mm-hmm. that actually at the, when you roll everything up at the end of the year, that, that factory facility is not putting any waste into a landfill. So we have those, I would say, initiatives going around the world, and our manufacturing facilities are jumping on board because that waste is controllable. You know, it is something that if you really focus on using your ingenuity, your problem-solving techniques, your ability to really continue to improve your manufacturing processes and understand your waste streams, you can really impact your and decrease the amount of waste you generate.
With that said, though, is there some piece of material, whether, you know, it's a part in a faucet or in a toilet or in a shower head, are there some materials that Kohler struggles with to recycle or reuse?
Gosh, great question. I would say, well, first of all, we're most proud of our ability to take vitreous china dust, which is comes out of, think of all the toilets and sinks that we make around the world in all of our facilities, and that can generate excess vitreous china. It's called, you know, cull. And so we're really proud that that material, and that's our largest manufacturing initiative globally, it can really be repurposed into, you know, roadbeds, paving material, things like that. We in fact donated material to a humane society for their pet, the base of their pet run. But we also started a small business unit called Waste Lab. Waste Lab takes the dust from a foundry, the foundry dust, which is iron, and the dust that comes out of vitreous china processes, and we have created a Waste Lab tile. We will be introducing some more products at the end of the year and into next year to expanding our tile collection sold under the Ann Saks brand. And so we're trying to take our waste and repurpose it, recycle it, either for product or for product that we sell under the Kohler brand, or we take it and put it into different partners in cities where we live and work into the municipal type of usage. So I think it just really, when you ask about, is there a material or a product that's more difficult? No, I mean, I think we just have to tackle every product, every material one by one. And that's the journey that we're on.
Every input in the manufacturing process. Laura Kohler, Kohler Company's Sustainability and Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Officer, as we look at the company's work in this area with about 40,000 employees. Call in with a question, share your insights about corporate sustainability and social impact. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we're in conversation with Wisconsin business executives, we focus on the global bath fixtures firm Kohler Company, appointing its First, Chief Sustainability and Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer joined its executive management structure this year. Call in with a question, share a comment about corporate values, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Laura Kohler with us. Laura, let's turn to DEI. What initiatives are you pursuing to improve diversity, equity, and inclusion at Kohler?
So we believe that inclusion is such an important part of our culture around the world, whether we're in India, whether we're here in Kohler, Wisconsin, whether we're in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, Europe, the UK. And really what that means is embracing difference, and difference helps deliver great innovation. Having more minds around the table, more different perspectives, different generations, different points of view really helps us continue to be the robust, innovative, really groundbreaking company that we've been for 150 years. And I can't say this enough, but it really did start with my great grandfather, who I'm fourth generation. And he really came to this country when he was nine and really believed that immigrants were part of the fabric of what would make Kohler Company successful in the future. And he and his sons really created a dormitory for immigrants to come here and from all over Europe and really come here and make money and then bring their families over. And so that's really been part of who we are for 150 years. And we continue to really want to attract and retain the best talent in the world for Kohler. And that entails ensuring that we have gender diversity. We have, you know, people of all different ethnicities that work and feel welcome at Kohler. So really continuing to work on how do we include, how do we both make Kohler a great place to live and work, and welcome difference. Well, so we upskill our leaders. We have inclusive leader program that every leader at Kohler, we have 3,600 leaders around the world. They are all going through an inclusive leader program to ensure that they're managing in ways that welcome difference. We have initiatives in our major locations, and we have a pipeline for talent in many of those locations that help bring talent to our locations. We have, I would say, BRGs, business resource groups, that are started by our associates. And we have Namaste, we have Black Catalyst, we have Kohler Vets, we have Kohler Viva, which is Latinx associates. We have 11 chapters. We have Kohler Bold Abilities, which is people with different abilities. We have a Kohler Caregiver group, who has come together and sharing their experience around caregiving and the stresses that brings. So we've really tried to open ourselves up to recognize the passion and the energy of our associates, how they want to keep creating an inclusive culture. We support their efforts, but we also go out into the world seeking more diverse representation at Kohler and then cultivating that inclusive environment through leader development.
June being Pride Month, Pride parades happening around the state, our governor flying a gay pride flag over the Capitol. Is Kohler making the month in some way to signal support for its LGBTQ plus workers?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was just marching in the Pride Parade in Milwaukee on Sunday, and we had over 50 associates in that parade. We had wrapped a truck in our heritage colors, celebrating our 150th year with a large Kohler Pride banner. We were led by Kohler Proud, which is our business resource group, which is incredibly active at Kohler around the world. And, you know, it was just a really amazing event. And it was walking down the streets in Walker's Point in Milwaukee, the energy from the community, the cheering, the faces, it was just a diverse and welcoming experience to be part of that. And so Kohler Company is continuing to both listen to our associates and where they want to put their energy, but also really listening to the world and really keeping up with and leading really in how can we continue to be a brand that attracts and retains and appreciates the diverse voice and attends to it, because our consumer is very diverse. Mm-hmm. So we certainly want to reflect that inside. So Pride Month is a big month for Kohler around the world. And we're also really focused on Juneteenth coming up on June 19th. And so our Black Catalyst group has activated, and then they will activate with initiatives, other associates in our communities.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. Laura Kohler with us, the Chief Sustainability and Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Officer of Kohler Company. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Laura, you talk about being fourth generation descendant of an immigrant who founded this major company, immigrant labor being a flashpoint in America, and Wisconsin's unemployment rate historically low. Is Kohler having trouble recruiting a diverse pool of candidates to meet your workforce goals?
So, you know, yes, I would say, as Wisconsin thrives, hopefully in the future, now and in the future, to be an attractive place for business, we also need to be an attractive place for talent, both to retain the really smart kids that are coming through our strong public school system, and after they go to tech school or college, we want to retain that talent. We also want to attract new talent to the state. And it matters not only to Kohler Company, it matters to all the different companies scattered around the state. The further you get away from Madison and Milwaukee, really and kind of further north and west, it is a challenge to continue to have that talent migration come north. So we want to be that, not only just a location where our headquarters is in Kohler, Wisconsin, but we want to be a state that attracts and retains diverse talent that really wants to build a career in Wisconsin. And, you know, so I care deeply about the talent pipeline that Wisconsin can develop, but also retain.
What would be that one tip that Wisconsin could do, that one change Wisconsin could make to be a better home for major employers like Kohler?
You know, I think continuing to invest in public education so that our schools become some of the strongest in the country, continue to invest in keeping our environment really as beautiful as it is. Wisconsin has amazing natural resources, keeping our waters, our lakes, our streams, our land, our trails really great for recreational purposes. Supporting our communities and our technical schools, investing in technical education. So not every kid is going to go to a four-year school. How can we help kids find other pathways to really viable, professional skills?
And that really lead to jobs. And Laura, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. And thanks, Kate, for having me.
Laura Kohler, Chief Sustainability and Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Officer of Kohler Company. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.